Okay, this is our special Pesach class from a car vote, 5773. I have mostly like different ideas to share in little nuggets, whether they're ideas that you'll be able to share at the Seder or think about yourself in your own preparations or share with women that you're learning with or conversing with as you prepare. Here's some different thoughts. So they're not necessarily all connected to each other, except they're all under the theme of Pesach. So the first idea that I want to share is about the Kos Eliyahu. And I don't remember, Javi, if I shared this with you or not, but I think this is an important concept just to think about. So and it's definitely an important concept to share with people who are making a first Seder or a few of their Seders, or who aren't sure that they feel totally connected to the material or ideas that they're sharing at the Seder. So here's the thought. Kos Eliyahu, right? So why do we have the Kos Eliyahu in the middle of our Seder table? I tried sharing this idea with my lapsed Hasidish daughter-in-law. She comes from a Ger family. And she wouldn't even listen to me. As soon as I said, we don't have the Kos Eliyahu on the table because Eliyahu actually comes and drinks from it, as soon as I said those words, she covered her ears and started stamping her feet and said, you're ruining my childhood. And she wouldn't listen any further. So it turns out that we don't believe that Eliyahu comes and drinks from that cup. It's actually a cup of question mark. That cup in the middle of the Seder table is actually a question mark in the middle of our Seder table, because it's a halachic question. What do? We drink four cups of wine, keneged the four Lashonot Geula. Right? So I'll read you in English the few psukim that we have that the words come from, the words of Hotzeti Vehitzalti Vega'alti Velakachti, right? So I'll just read in English so you can hear them. So this is in Shmot Perek Vav, Sukkim 6-8. Okay. Therefore, say to the children of Israel, I am Hashem. I shall take you out, right, v'hotzeiti, from under the burdens of Egypt. I shall rescue you, v'ga'alti, from their service. I should look at the Hebrew, right, v'hotzeiti, v'ga'alti, right. The next one is, v'hotzeiti, v'hitzalti is the second one. I shall rescue you from their service. I shall redeem you, v'ga'alti, with an outstretched arm and with great judgments. I shall take you, v'lakachti, to me for a people, and I shall be a God to you. Okay, so that's where we usually end because we drink four cups, but it continues. And you shall know that I am Hashem your God who takes you out from under the burdens of Egypt. I shall bring you, v'heveti, to the land about which I raised my hand to give it to Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, and I shall give it to you as a heritage. I am Hashem. So actually, we have five Lishanot Geula, right? V'hotzeti, v'hitzalti, v'ga'alti, v'lakachti, v'heveti. But the first four happened already, and the fifth one, v'heveti, is not referring, v'heveti el ha'aretz, I'll bring you into the land, is not referring to the biblical bringing us into the land. It's referring to the future bringing us into the land. Hopefully, the part that we're in right now of the Jews going into the land. But if we would be speaking 100 years ago, we'd say it's referring to the future, right? So that, the Heveti, it didn't happen yet. Whether it's happening now or not, it still didn't happen yet. It's not past tense yet. So the question is, what do we do with that Lashon, Geula? Do we drink a cup for that or not? And we forgot the Halacha. So it's a very rare case in Jewish law where we actually compromise. We pour the fifth cup, but we don't drink it. And we put it on the table, in the middle of our Seder table, and we call it the Kos Eliyahu, because Eliyahu HaNavi, before Mashiach comes, is going to come and answer all the questions that we have. If we're not sure of the halacha, he's going to tell us the halacha. Should we eat kibrachs or not? Should we eat kitniot or not? Should we whatever else? I'm sure there's a lot of shilohs, not just those, but they come to mind. Should we drink this cup or not? We have a lot of halachic shahs that we've lost the answers to, and he'll answer them. So it's called the Kos Eliyahu based on the fact that it's a question mark, and we don't know the answer, and Eliyahu will answer it. So that's why how it got its name. But let's think about the implication of it. So this is what's important, I think, to learn from it. We have a question mark in the middle of our Seder table. And that says to us, this night of passing on emuna and mesura to my children, to my relatives, to those who are at my table, it's a night where I'm passing on everything I have, but I don't have it all. I have questions. And that question, there's one question right in the middle of the Seder table that represents the questions that I have, the parts that I don't know. But that's not going to stop me from passing on what I do know. There's stuff that I do know, and I'm going to share that, even in the face of that which I don't know. And just because I don't know it doesn't mean it's not known. Somebody knows it. Eliyahu's going to come and answer those questions. So there are things I don't know. That's not going to stop me from passing on what I do know. And just because I don't know them doesn't mean they're not known. The answers are known, just I don't know them. So it's really two very important messages. One, it's okay not to know. And just because you don't know doesn't mean it's not known. It might be known, just you don't. And two, you can still pass on what you do know, even in the face of what you don't. So that's really the message of the Kos Eliyahu. It's not that Eliyahu is going to come sit from it, but that we'll find out in the end what the answers are. And meanwhile, we can still hang on throughout history in the face of question marks. So that's vort number one for Kos Eliyahu. Mm-hmm. So number two, we're called Bnei B'chori by Hashem, my firstborn son, right? And B'chori, firstborn, son B'chor, sounds like B'char, chosen. It's a chet and a chaf. But otherwise the word is the same. So it sounds the same, but spelled differently. So chosen and firstborn. So that's definitely who we are as Jews to Hashem. And yet we're not the firstborn nation. There are other nations before the Jewish people. But we are chosen as Hashem's firstborn, whether or not we're physically the first. So we have to look into that. What does that mean? And how does that relate to Pesach? So this is the time, Rabbi Forman has some interesting stuff online to learn more about these concepts, but I'm not sharing his ideas. I didn't look through all. He has a series of, I think, 8 videos right now on aish.com that you can look and see more about what does it mean to be firstborn. And he asks some questions, which I can't answer because I didn't finish listening to everything, but I'll just give one piece of a question. Something that's so strong about Yetziat Mitzrayim and firstborn is that one of the parshiot in the Tefillin is about Peterechem, the chamor Peterechem, the firstborn donkey. Like, it seems like a weird thing to put in Tefillin. So I don't have the answer to the question, just the question, like, why do we put that there? But the concept of being firstborn and of being chosen are very close together. So for this, I think we need to look at how do we become Jewish in the first place? Right. So this is part of our Derech Hashem series. I just want to review some of the things from Derech Hashem, but it really begs the question, Pesach time, this is the birth of the Jewish people. So how do we go from being really Bnei Chava and Adam, all people on the planet are their children, to becoming a subset of people who are actually spiritually separated from the rest of humanity by a different neshama, different spiritual being of neshama. All human beings have a neshama, but Jews have a different one. And when we talk about the levels of creation on the planet, we talk about domeim, inanimate, tzomeach, plants or flowering things, growing things, tzomeach, chai, animals, medaber, speakers, so we define human beings as speakers, and then on top of speakers comes Yisrael. So we actually see ourselves as a different Bria, really. So how did, but except for we do descend from Adam and Chava, so how do we get there? How do we transform our spiritual status? So it started with Avraham. So Avraham, and I just noticed today when I looked up the psukim so that I could quote them properly, in the Bris Bein Besarim, the Brit Bein Betarim, which is in chapter 15 of Breishit. Let's see, I'll find the right words. I just noticed as I was looking at the words, because I always mix up the suffs and tufs there, if it's Bris Bein Betarim or Vrit Bene Bassarm, like how that works. So I just looked up to make sure. And as I was looking at the letters, I noticed that Bris and Basar, with a suf, are the same letters. They're just reversed, right? So it's Bris is Bet Resh Suf, and Basar is Bet Suf Resh. I didn't get a chance to look that up in the Hirsch dictionary, but I just thought it's interesting that we have this covenant between the parts. That's what we call it in English, the covenant between the parts. Mm-hmm. So covenant is bringing something together, and parts is something that's separate. So this is the bringing together of the disparate parts. So it's interesting to think about. This is where the Jewish people are really born, is in these psukim. So let's look at this. Okay, so we have basically this concept of Adam and Chava being the first human beings, and then they make a big mistake, right, eating from a tree they never should have had a snack from, and that completely transforms all of humanity and brings us to a much, physically transforms our body and completely transforms the reality of the world and the reality of the heavens, so that everything is shifted because of that first chait that they did. But the potential of who we could have been remained in potential form. The potential, what we could achieve as humans, didn't disappear. Just our reality shifted. So our physical reality shifted. But the potential remained the same. So Hashem waited for 2,000 years. Abraham was born, if we count zero from when Adam got a soul, and Abraham was born in that count in the year 1948. So it's almost 2,000 years later when he was born. So those first 2,000 years of history are called the years of Tohu Vavohu, the years of confusion and mix-up and before Torah. So then we have Abraham who comes along. He's not the first monotheist. There are other monotheists before him. Adam, for instance, Noach, Shem, Aver, a few other people along the way are monotheists. But if you contrast Abraham with Noach, you'll see that Noach, who spent 120 years building a teva on dry land, right, when he got into the teva, he brought with him only his wife, his three sons, and their wives, and no neighbors, right? He didn't do kiruv at all. He didn't reach out to anybody. He was a monotheist, but not a monotheist with a mission. He just built the teva because Hashem said, build it. He filled the teva because Hashem said, fill it. But he didn't take his own action and say, wait a second, there's something we have to do. We have to save the rest of humanity. So he didn't. So he was just a monotheist, not a monotheist with a mission. But Abraham was a monotheist with a mission. He wanted to change the world because of the fact of a one God reality. So when he first figured that out and discussed it with Hashem, right, Hashem said, Hashem reveals himself to him in this chapter 15, or a little before, but they have a conversation here. Now, it's a strange conversation. I'll read it to you, but you'll hear that it's a little bit strange. Abraham asks Hashem a question, Hashem answers the question, and it doesn't make any sense. So we have to hear it the way it's written, not the way maybe we've learned it in the past, but what's actually going on here. So Hashem says, I am Hashem who brought you out of Ur Kasdim to give you this land to inherit it. Right? So let's see, before that Hashem says to him, we're gonna work together. You're going to inherit this land. Abraham, who's not Abraham yet, Abraham says, I don't have any children. I don't see how I'm going to inherit the land. And Hashem says, don't worry. This is when he takes him out, shows him the stars. You're going to have as many offspring as the stars. And Abraham trusts in Hashem. And then Hashem says, I'm Hashem who brought you out of Ur Kasdim to give you the land to inherit it. And Abraham says to him, Hashem, b'me'edah, how will I know that I'm going to inherit it? Right? So first of all, he's talking to Hashem. How could he possibly say, how will I know? B'me'edah, how will I know? What sign will I have? Right? How will I know? So that's question number one. But that's the question that he asks of Hashem. How will I know? And here's Hashem's answer. Okay? And he said to him, take to me 3 heifers, 3 goats, 3 rams, a turtle dove, and a young dove. And Avram took all these, he took all these to him, cut them in the center, placed each one opposite its counterpart. The birds, however, he did not cut up. Birds of prey descended upon the carcasses, and Avram drove them away. And it happened, as the sun was about to set, a deep sleep fell upon Avram, and behold, a dread, a great darkness fell upon him. And he said to Avram, "Know with certainty that your offspring shall be strangers in a strange land, and they will serve them, and they will oppress them 400 years. But also the nation they will serve I'll judge, and afterwards they'll leave with great wealth. As for you, you shall come to your ancestors in peace. You shall be buried in a good old age, and the fourth generation shall return here, for the iniquity of the Amorites shall not yet be full until then." Okay, so there's the question. How will I know I'm going to inherit the land? And the answer is, your children will be strangers in a strange land. They'll be oppressed and miserable, suffer, and then get a lot of stuff and go out. It's a very strange question, and it's a very strange answer. So I'll tell you, I'll re-paraphrase it the way our sages explain it, okay? So what Abraham is saying to God is not, "How will I know?" Because he's talking to God. Obviously, if God says, "You're going to inherit the land," you're going to inherit the land. But it's not just about the land. It's about inheriting the whole thing, inheriting the mission of the Jews. All right, so Abraham is saying, "Okay, God, I understand. I made myself different. I became an Ivri by standing on the other side of world opinion and aligning myself with you and your mission. I get it, okay? I did that, and that's why you want to work with me, that we could try to bring all humanity into a relationship with you. But now you're telling me that my children are going to inherit this too. First of all, I don't have children. But second of all, let's say I do. What are they going to do to become Ivriim? What are they going to do to earn this position with you?" And so then that's the Beme'eda. How will I know is really interpreted as, how will they earn it too? How will they get to this place? And Hashem says, "Don't worry. I have a custom-designed workshop just for them. It's called Mitzrayim. I'm going to send them into Mitzrayim, a land of licentious idolatry, hedonism, magic, and they're going to have their opportunity to live there, to be squeezed there and oppressed there, also attracted by what Mitzrayim has to offer. They'll have their opportunity to earn the title Ivri, to stand on the other side of all of that." But he's, so there's two things. One is God tells Avram that he makes a promise that he's going to inherit and his children will inherit. And two is he tells him the mechanism through which they will inherit. So that's the beginning of the story, right? Then we go into Mitzrayim, and it's only through the Exodus that we actually become Jewish. It's a two-part process that Derech Hashem explains, and I guess because I want to get to other things, I probably won't quote inside from the book, but it's in the chapter, if anybody wants to look it up, Israel and the Nations, which is part two, chapter four, which explains in detail how the shift happened from Gentile to Jew. But basically what happened is a two-part process. As we went into Mitzrayim, first it was pretty easy, and then it got harder and harder, squeezed tighter and tighter and tighter, and the Jews were, I imagine, Mitzrayim, the root is tsar, narrow, like tsaris. I imagine us being put through like the ringers of a hand crank washing machine, where we're wrung out, squeezed so tightly there's not a drop left. But there still is dampness if you wring something out that tightly, and it's very absorbent at that point. So first we were wrung out through the Mitzrayim experience, and then brought out and brought straight to Sinai, where we received the Torah. So we were brought, wrung out, and extremely absorbent to Har Sinai, where we, in our wrung out places, were able to absorb the or of the Torah. If our job is to be an or l'goyim, we absorbed the or of the Torah at Har Sinai, which is only a beginning process. So that's a whole different discussion. We haven't yet achieved what we're supposed to achieve as a Jewish people, but that was the beginning of the process, is that we came out of Mitzrayim and we went to Har Sinai. So we were squeezed tight, and then we absorbed a lot. Let me just see here. Okay, so at Har Sinai is where we absorbed the Torah. It sounds like or in the middle of Torah, even though that's not how we pronounce it. I tell Baal Tshuvas I write it out for them how to pronounce Torah, because you can tell a BT often because I say Torah, and you hear the or more. So I write it at T-O-E-R-A-H, Torah, right? You have to say it that way, not Torah. But you hear the Ur in the middle, but there's no Aleph. So there's not really, etymologically, there's not really light in the middle of Torah. Torah is law. It means law, right? It's related to Hora, parent, or Mora, teacher, because they both teach and guide by some confines of the law. So Torah really means law. So so here's the next little vort about the law and how we, if we're supposed to shine the light, then what's the point of getting a law? Right? I don't. Did I tell you this about Saudi Arabia and Mexico and America?
I don't remember you saying that.
Okay. Okay, so here's my vort about the law. Okay, so Saudi Arabia. In Saudi Arabia, are women free?
Nope.
No, they're not. They have to wear a veil. They can't drive. They can't go on the street without a man, without permission. They can't leave the country. They can't get an education without permission from their husband or their father. They can't walk anywhere unaccompanied without a male, and they can't walk anywhere without a veil over their face. It's hard to imagine. I mean, we think about veiled women, but just think for a moment what it would be like from age about 9 or 10 to never, ever be able to go outside and see clearly. You can't see the sky well. You can't see the trees well. You can't see the sidewalk. Of course you can't drive because you can't see. It's not safe. Welcome. Oh, I guess somebody joined and left. Anyway, so you can't see. So Saudi Arabia, women are not free. Why? Because they have bad laws in Saudi Arabia and good enforcement. Right, so women are imprisoned by the laws in Saudi Arabia and the fact that they're well enforced. Then, a few weeks ago when I was in Mexico, so I wanted to see a little bit of the downtown Mexico City, so somebody said, okay, I'll send you with a driver and a bodyguard. I said, why? I could just go with a friend. We'll walk around downtown. And he said, no, a woman can't walk alone. It's not safe. You need to have somebody with you. I'll send one of my men with you. So so we had a driver, and he walked close to us the whole time and made sure that we were safe. I noticed that nobody wears their rings there, so I took my rings off and left them in the ashtray in the car. I didn't even tell the driver where I left them because I was nervous. Apparently, there's a lot of theft. You can't count on the police. You can't even count on your maids. One woman told me she has maids, but she keeps her closet locked. When her maids go to put her laundry away, they have to call her for her to unlock her closet so they can put away her clothes, and then she locks it back up so that her maids won't steal from her. So I thought, like, who wants to live like that? You know, in a lawless society, you're not free, and women can't walk around by themselves, and everybody lives behind a gate. Not just they lock their front doors, but they have a whole big fence in front of their house, in front of all the houses, to prevent intruders from coming in. So it's a double lock system. And some people who are wealthy have triple because they have a guard and dogs on their property and a gate and their house is locked. So what is that, right? So in Mexico, you are not free. You can't just walk around. Why? They have good laws in Mexico, but they have terrible enforcement because they have lawlessness with all the drug cartels and gangs and vigilante justice. You can't count on anybody there. So bad laws, I mean good laws, bad enforcement, no freedom. In the United States, and possibly in England too, I'm not sure, but let's just talk about the United States because I'm more familiar with the law here. Right? In the United States, the only Judeo-Christian country on the planet, not called Judeo-Christian because of the amount of Jews living here, but because it actually is founded on Jewish values, which is a whole other discussion, but it's a Judeo-Christian country. So in this country, women are free, and they can walk pretty much, not everywhere, but pretty much anywhere in safety. Why? Because in this country, again, not perfectly, but generally, we have just and fair laws, so fair and so just, that pretty much everybody, not everyone, but pretty much everybody buys into it. Everybody agrees to keep the laws because they're actually fair. The taxes are pretty fair. The traffic law is fair. The courts are relatively fair and just. And people basically trust it. So everybody agrees to keep the laws. And for those people who are either lazy or evil around the edges, we have good enforcement, right, in most areas. The unsafe areas are where we don't have good enforcement. But basically we have good laws and good enforcement, which makes people in this country free. You can do what you want. You can have transactions. You can trust the banks. You can trust the police. You can trust the education system, basically, because it's fair. So good laws and good enforcement set people free, and then they can have a life where they can work together with others and try to accomplish things. Right? America's not trying to take over Canada, and Canada's happy to live next to America. And Mexico, we would like to see, Americans would like to see a little more police presence in Mexico and less lawlessness. But basically, the countries get along, and we're not trying to take over each other because we do live in synergy next to each other. So good law frees people. That's what the Torah is about. The Torah is about giving us a law that when we all recognize it in our guts, we see that it's good and fair and just and empowering and enhancing. And we don't have a police system in Torah. Right, we all are supposed to contribute together. If anybody, two witnesses of any type together witness somebody about to commit a crime and give them warning, witness and warning, so then they can be punished from that. But we don't have a police system to keep the Torah. Basically, it's supposed to be, and yes, we're still not there, and we do break down around the edges for sure. But in general, it's a system of law that's good and fair that keeps our society running well and allows us to be empowered to work with each other and enhances each person. So the law actually provides the light. If we can, and again, we haven't achieved it yet, but if we can, not just live as communities, but if we can, we're supposed to build a state in Eretz Yisrael. There's supposed to be a Jewish state there eventually, a Torah state. It should be that people will look at us as a government, as individuals, as business people, as music teachers, as file clerks, and say, wow, what makes you like that? How do you shine so brightly? Right? How are your marriages that way? How is your business that way? How are your streets that way? How is your government that way? Whatever you guys have, that's what we want. You're shining so brightly. That's the Jewish program, is to be shiners of the light, is shiners of the law, living within the law and shining the light through that. So that's why Pesach is Zman Cherusenu. It's the time of our freedom. Not because we got out of Mitzrayim, because it's Shlach et Ami v'Yavduni. Send my people free that they should serve me. Right? So it's not that we were freed from one paro and now we go to the next, ruler. It's we are released by the law that Hashem gives us, so that we're not slaves now not to our whims and not to society and not to different passions, but the law actually does give us freedom.
Right. So when you say that we should be a light unto... Mm-hmm. Sorry, do you want to say something?
No, I was just going to say that's that word on the law. The law is man chirutinu.
You often say we should be a light unto the nations. Not necessarily is Torah law attractive to other people. Take modesty, for instance, or lots of things that look weird to the outer
world.
That's
correct. When we function properly as a society, which we're not yet, we're in Gullus. Gullus doesn't just mean physically we're not living in the land of Israel. Gullus means that there's a disconnect between what Hashem wants from us and what we're actually producing, what the connection that we have with Hashem, feeling it. So even today, a frum Jew who believes in Hashem and understands, let's say, the brachos, why they make the brachos, what bracha is on each food, right, and tries to have kavana when they say them, still they're disconnected when they make that bracha. They don't get the full flavor of the bracha on a regular basis. Occasionally, maybe there's a good bracha here and there. But because we're in Gullus, because we are disconnected, because we don't live with the spiritual reality of Torah life, even those people who are living a lot with Torah values. So on the one hand, you're right, that you can, if you separate out parts, then you can say, oh, Tznias, who needs that? You have to be so restricted in what you dress and how you walk, the jokes you tell. But on the other hand, if you look at, and just take a little slice of Hasidic society, as we discussed earlier, that little slice, and it's probably small, but that little slice of people who really are happy with what they have, happy with the life that they have, and not happy at the thought of leading another lifestyle, right? And then there are people on the outside who sometimes get a glimpse through a movie or whatever of people who have families, marriages where each partner is faithful to the other, where the children love their parents, where the grandparents are close by and the sisters live near the mother, and they get along well and they have family time. And, you know, the idyllic scene that I went once to see a movie, it was called Stranger Among Us, which had a beautiful depiction. It was really a mystery, but it was set in a from community. And a police officer, a female police officer, was posing as a Balchuva in order to be undercover. So it had all these lovely scenes of Jewish life. Challah baking, the Shabbos table, singing at the Shabbos table. So I saw this movie on a Motzei Shabbos in a Jewish neighborhood. It's all Jews in the theater. And everybody was talking and commenting on the movie the whole time. Sure, my Shabbos table is just like that. Yes, I always make challahs just like that. Like, the movie was so beautiful. But everybody in the audience knew that's not what their life looked like. Finally, in the audience, everybody was talking so much. Finally, somebody tried to shut up the audience and said, "Would you guys be quiet? Where do you think you are? In shul?" Yeah. So I was one of those. I think it was maybe 20 years ago, but I'll never forget that night. Of hearing the comments and hearing that comment. But anyway, there are people who would catch a slice of the beauty that can be part of the Jewish community, and they want it. You know, how beautiful. I just spoke on a college campus in Madison, Wisconsin, and we talked about intimacy and sexuality and what the sexual relationship is about and how you're using the goof to knit two soul halves together and what it is to have a soulmate and how you use it and what sex is for, and it shouldn't just be shared with anyone but shared with your special partner, et cetera, et cetera. And at the end, the boys listened and they left at the end, but the girls stayed with a lot of questions, and about five of them at the end were all like swooning. Oh, we want to get married. All of them. It was so interesting just to watch these girls, like they never thought of it before. Here they are, right, the right age to get married. They're 19, 20 years old, right? And they just for the first time heard that there's actually a soulmate waiting for them to start a life with, to knit their two soul halves together, to use the sexual relationship to bond the couple, to build a world, right, to create a home. They never heard that before. And now they're thinking, oh, my gosh, look what I've spread around and how destructive that was. So anyway, once you hear a slice of how beautiful it can be, people want it. The reason why something like tznius looks bad is because we're not yet fully living what we should be living. Tznius looks good if people understand what it is and if there's not the cultural overlay of the occasional male dominance or misunderstanding of it or repression. A lot of laws today are taught through repression rather than through empowerment. So if you just teach a little girl, you have to cover up, you have to cover up, you have to cover up, and that's what tznius is, so then she feels repressed. Ugh, I can never wear what I want. Rather than, you have a special neshama, and we want your neshama to be with that which is recognized by others, and your body is also beautiful but can be distracting from your soul. So we want to make sure that your body is there to serve your soul and not to distract from your soul. And so we cover the body in a way that lets your soul shine first and your body be its servant. Right, that's a totally different message. So I think if people would dress and shine that message through their clothing rather than I have to cover myself up, I have to cover myself up, or even worse, I have to cover myself up because the men in my neighborhood are animals and they can't keep their thoughts to themselves and therefore it's my responsibility to protect them from themselves, right? So then what? Then it is a system of repression.
Right.
So it depends on how it's taught, but the truth is Torah is gorgeous, taught right and lived right, which we're in Gaulis, so it's not always taught right and it's not always lived right. But taught right and lived right, the Torah is gorgeous, and it creates a society and homes and families and businesses that are honest and clean and beautiful to look at, to be a part of, And when we can live that way, it will be attractive. People will want it, and they'll be attracted to us for it. Okay, next. let's just think for a minute about the two meals on either side of the Mitzrayim experience. Just something I recently saw. Right, so the first meal is the meal that's had right after Yosef is thrown into the pit. So Yosef, the younger brother, goes to find his brothers with the sheep in the field, right? His father sends him out. The brothers see him coming and say, that dreaming boy, him and his dreams of superiority, will fix him. And they snatch him and throw him into a pit, which is full of snakes and scorpions. And the next pasuk, after it says, V'habor reik ein bo mayim, right? It's an empty pit. And Rashi says that means it's empty of water, but it's full of snakes and scorpions. So he's got to be petrified. His brothers just threw him into a pit he can't get out of. The very next pasuk is, they sat down and they ate. They didn't walk anywhere. They sat down and they ate. So they must, those 10 brothers, must have sat listening to him cry and ate. They were able to sit and have a meal while they hear their brother sobbing for his life, petrified in a pit not too far away. Right? So that's the first meal. That's the meal that brings us into Mitzrayim. So that's a meal of preda, really, a meal of separation, a meal of taking apart a family.
Where do you speak about these two meals?
Well, so think about the second meal is the Seder. Right? That's the tikkun, in a way. The Seder is the tikkun for that meal. Because here, we're supposed to, we can't change the world on our own. Right? It's not enough to be one person, Abraham, a monotheist with a mission. He couldn't do it alone. So we're not called the B'nai Abraham, and we're not called the B'nai Yitzchak. We're called the B'nai Yisrael. Because we needed Yisrael to have 12 sons that were the seeds of a nation, the Shvatim, that would create enough of a critical mass that we could create enough of a society that would shine brightly enough that we would be that paradigm that of attraction of light in the world, that people would be attracted to us. One person can't do it and one family can't do it. We have to be a nation. But we need the foundation of a nation is a family. So we needed that large family. And that large family was being broken apart by the sale of Yosef, first by the what might have been the killing of Yosef, but then the retreat and the sale of Yosef broke apart this family and broke apart the dream of creating a nation with these principles embedded in it. But then Hashem had other plans. He already made a promise. We are going to be that nation. It is going to be through this family. And so he arranged everything that the very sale of Yosef led to the fulfillment of the dreams. Right? If they hadn't snatched him and thrown him in the pit and then sold him to the Midianites who were passing on the way, then those dreams wouldn't have come true like he dreamt them. So they were trying to thwart the dreams. Exactly what they did made the dreams come true. So then Hashem takes us out of Mitzrayim and says, okay, you're out of Mitzrayim, you need a Seder. So think about the Seder for a minute, okay? So we have the Seder, we invite it's our family, maybe some friends, maybe not, depending. Probably not too much in the Hasidic community because it's mostly families together, right? But think about this for a minute. When you eat the afikoman, how much room do you have left in you? Right? It's a chore almost to eat the afikoman, right?
Right.
Especially when it's a shear, like you start with a little piece that's actually from the afikoman, and then your father or whoever, a husband, passes around extra for everybody to eat, and you look at it and you think, really? I have to sit that in time. How am I going to do that? And you start to just chew and chew and chew, and there's a little giggling because everybody's chewing, trying to get it down, right? So now imagine that instead of getting that piece of matzah, you bring out the lamb. Really, that's when we eat the Karban Pesach. After the Seuda, we're supposed to eat the entire Karban Pesach, the whole thing, all the way down to the very end. You're not allowed to leave a bite over till the morning. The whole Karban Pesach has to be eaten after the Seuda. So imagine, instead of getting that piece of matzah, you got a hunk of lamb. How many people would have to be sitting at your Seder table to be able to polish off an entire lamb for dessert?
Mm-hmm.
right? Not just your family. You have to make a chabura. You have to unite a few families together. Because even if you're even a Hasidic family, right, with 10 kids and 5 of them are teenage boys, they would have a hard time polishing off a whole lamb after a seuda. So you have to join together. So the point of this meal, of the Pesach meal, is here we are being born as a Jewish people. That's what Pesach is about, the birth of the Jewish nation, the transformation, the beginning of the transformation of all humanity rests in Pesach. And for that, Hashem says, have a meal with a lot of people. It's not just about you. You can't do this alone. You have to join together with others. Because being the Jewish people means joining together with others to accomplish our mission. So the first meal going in is the family falling apart. And the meal coming out is the family increasing itself and joining together with other families.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's that thought. Let's see. Next one that I want to go to.
The what?
I said just the next thought that I want to go to. That's the two meals, okay? So Shulchan Aruch, when we get to Shulchan Aruch and the Seuda, just think about the fact that this is not a break from the Seder. This is part of the Seder, right? It's not when do we get to eat, but rather this is part of the whole thing, part of creating Seder and part of the whole passing on of Emunah includes being a family together, sharing food together, and sharing good experiences, hopefully some Divrei Torah, all together at that moment. It's part of the Seder. And it's a tikkun for that meal of the brothers when they threw Yosef into the pit. Okay, now let's move on to before the meal, right? There's four questions. That's what starts Magid, right? Four questions. Four specific questions asked by the youngest one. So four clear questions. Where are the answers to those questions?
You asking me?
Yeah. Point. Think about it in the Haggadah. Where are those?
You don't really get
answered?
It. You...
Right. They're never answered, right?
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm.
Right. I mean, four clear questions that there could be answers to. They're not answered at all. The answer starts with Avadim Hayinu. Basically, the answer is, okay, there's a lot to understand here, son. Let's start from the beginning. Let's start a dynamic conversation, right? I'm not going to give you a quick answer to those questions because that's not what it's about. Questioning is fundamental to the free human being. Part of being human is asking why, what, where, what is this about? How does this matter? How is it important? Right? Asking questions is so important. When we were in Mitzrayim, our koach hadibur was enslaved also. Our very ability to speak was taken away from us. We couldn't. That's why the pasuk says when we got out that Hashem heard our groaning. He didn't hear our tefillos because we weren't davening. We couldn't. All we could say is, like a woman in labor. All she can do is moan because it's so painful. She can't even say, Hashem, please take away the pain. Just moaning, right? It's a tefillah, really, that is pre-verbal. It doesn't even get to the stage of words. It's interesting to think about Rosh Hashanah and Pesach both being New Year's, which they are, right? Because Pesach is the first month. Nisan is the first month. We count months from Nisan. We count years from Tishrei. But both those Rosh Hashanahs, because they are considered Rosh Hashanahs, they both have a nonverbal tefillah associated with them, right? Rosh Hashanah has a shofar, and where we go past language, where we blow out of our mouths and we bypass words to make that tefillah. And Pesach has that pre-language tefillah, where we can't even get it up to the level of words.
So what do we actually do now?
So what we don't actually do anything with that now. We just understand that, so what we do now is we speak. That's why it's Pesach, right? That's one meaning of the word. Pesach is the mouth that speaks. And the principal mitzvah of the night is to speak Haggadah, Sipur Yetziat Mitzrayim. Tell the story. Use your mouth. Ask questions. A slave who's oni, right, la'anot is to torture somebody, right? La'anot is to be tortured, right? La'anot is to answer. So you have torture and answer as the same root, or oppression and answer as the same root. So if you have somebody who's a slave, you're causing them, when you cause them oni, you're causing them to answer to you. Right? Their whole life is only about answering to you. They're not allowed to question anything. You tell them to clean the bathrooms and they can't say why I cleaned them yesterday. You know, you can't. If you're a slave, you just do what you're told. There are no questions. But once you're free, it's not the answers that are important, but your ability to ask. And that's how we start the Seder. Why is this night different? What's the story with this? Why do we do that? Why is this that way? Ask questions. It's all about how do we ask and how do we ask and how do we ask. We exercise our humanity by speaking. So we have this mitzvah of speaking. So the Seder has dual mouth mitzvahs, right? The mitzvah of stuff coming out of our mouth, Sipur Yetziat Mitzrayim, and then the mitzvahs that go into our mouth, the matzah and the maror. So our mouth is the principal tool that we bring to the Seder table. So just as a practical thing, I think it's something to consider preparing that tool as we prepare our homes, getting the chametz out of our homes, that we might want to consider preparing our mouths for the Seder also by being extra careful with Shemiras HaLashon, or saying kind things and not saying mean things, because we want to bring a kosher LePesach mouth to the table also, so that we can use it for the speaking that's necessary. Mm-hmm. To free ourselves from the negative words that we might be saying. So we have the choice to say positive things at the Seder table. Okay, there's so much more to share that I want to share, but I want to share one more.
Oh, it's all so nice.
Yeah, it's getting late, but there's one more thing I want to share. Let's see. Or should I share two more? That's late for you. Okay, so one more. So, lechem oni. Okay, so we call it the bread of affliction or the bread of poverty, right? So, of course, there's the joke every year. I don't know if you tell it at your Seder table, but we do. That's called lechem oni. Why? Because it's so expensive, it makes you poor to buy it, right? But that, of course, is not the real reason. It's called lechem oni because that's what poor people eat. Why? It's the bread that's so fast to make. You don't wait for it to rise, right? All you do is mix flour and water. You have no time. You have no energy. You have no creativity left over as an oppressed slave. All you can do is just take care of your basic sustenance and mix together flour and water, bake it, done, eat it. That's it. You just need something basic. So it's called lechem oni. So the question is then, why do we eat matzah today? I mean, isn't this the holiday of our freedom? Why do we have to eat lechem oni? To remember the slavery or to remember the freedom? Like, what are we trying to commemorate on this night? Matzah is so important. So it sounds strange to be eating the food, the bread of affliction, when we're celebrating the night of our freedom. So it's an interesting thought that I just learned this year. I learned it from Pinchas Stopler in his book Living Beyond Time, that eating that reminds us of the chipazon, that we got out very quickly, right? So we know that, right? So we left so quickly that our dough couldn't rise. Well, wait a second. We were planning on leaving for a long time. And what was the rush? We were tortured for 210 years. We couldn't wait an extra hour and a half to prepare the proper provisions to take with us on a long journey in the desert? We had to leave that second? So what's up with that is the question. How did we have to leave that second after 210 years? So the answer is, or an answer is, that, yeah, we did have to leave that second because the Mitzrayim chased us out. We need to know that this exodus had nothing to do with us, really. You could say, oh, we were 600,000 men, which we were, right? 600,000 men plus their wives, plus the children, plus the people over 60 or under 20, 3 million people, right? You could say 3 million people, we finally had a slaves revolt And it worked, and we freed ourselves. But that's why we eat the lechem oni, to remind us, nope, we were chased out. We had to leave quickly. We didn't even have chance to take provisions with us. Even though we knew this day was coming, they chased us out so fast that we did not have the ability to take with us the kind of provisions that we wanted, because the only one acting with free will in the moment of the Exodus was Hashem. Hashem used his ratzon to cause our oppressors to chase us out, so that they didn't have free will and we didn't have free will at the time. We were just chased, squeezed out so quick that we had to quickly leave. So for that reason, we eat the lechem oni, right, the bread of affliction, to show that we were chased out so quickly. But also for that and other reasons, we eat an egg at the Seder. So do you have the minhag to eat an egg at your Seder?
I think so, but why do we do it? Is it not Korban Chagiga or something?
Right, so the one reason is the Korban Chagiga. That's why we have an egg actually on the Seder plate, is the Korban Chagiga. But why do we eat a hard-boiled egg at the Seder? So another reason is possibly it's for mourning, that we're remembering the loss of life during that time, and egg is round, and that's what mourners eat, so that's another explanation that I've heard. But the explanation that, and there's lots of different explanations, here's the one that I really like, okay? When we came out of Mitzrayim, it was a double birth process. We were squeezed out very quickly, but we weren't yet born as a Jewish people, right? An egg is squeezed out of the chicken, just like the Jewish people were taken out, an am mikerev am, a nation out of another nation, like an egg coming out of a chicken. First the egg's inside, and then it pops out, squeezed out, b'chipazon. Right, so the Jewish people were squeezed out by the Mitzrim, but we weren't born yet. We had to incubate for 49 days in the desert, wandering around, waiting until we got to Har Sinai. That was our second birth, where we actually pecked our way out of the shell and received the Torah. That's the part that we took part in, where we said Na'aseh v'nishma, and that completed our birth process. So we eat an egg to remind us of something that's born twice, like the Jews, born once coming out of Mitzrayim, but not fully the Jewish people yet. Still in the desert before we got the Torah, everybody could choose in or choose out. We weren't fully Jewish yet, right? We had the squeezing ceremony taken care of, but we didn't yet have the light absorption ceremony taken care of at Sinai. Once we got the Torah at Sinai, that's when there is no return. That's when once you're Jewish and you can never leave. Until we got the Torah, it was by choice. So it was a double birth process, like laying an egg and then incubating and then hatching. So one reason why we eat the egg at the Seder table is to remind us this is the egg part. When we came out of the chicken, when the Jewish people came out of the Mitzrim, a nation from amidst another nation, and now we're going to start the incubation process for Sinai.
Lovely.
So, oh gosh, there's one more thing I have to share. Sorry.
And
that's why it's called Pesach. Okay, so we said Pesach, but Pesach, right? Why is it called Pesach, Passover? Right? It doesn't really make sense that the right away answer is it's named after the fact that Hashem passed over our houses, right, in the last plague. But really, this is a holiday of our freedom. It should be called like Chag HaAtzmaut or Chag HaCherut or something like that, not Pesach.
Right.
We don't call it Plague Day. It's just weird that the holiday that commemorates the formation of the Jewish people is called Passover. It's a strange name. So looking deeper, and I'll just share very quickly, but looking deeper into that name, what was passed over? Were the Jews ready to come out of Mitzrayim when we came out?
No.
No. We had sunk into the 49th level of Tumah, and some sages say that we were scooped out before we would hit the 50th level, because if we would have made it down to that level, there would have been nothing left to redeem. But Hashem promised. We didn't deserve it. We didn't earn it, right? That's why we started off the class with looking at the promise that Hashem said. I'm going to send your children into Mitzrayim. They're going to be oppressed, and then they're going to be released and given a lot of stuff, right? So we didn't actually earn it.
But then we did deserve it because we were oppressed. That was part
of the plan. Well, we did. We were put through the ringer, but we didn't earn it ourselves. We didn't earn the release, and that's what was passed over. that Hashem pasach not just on our houses, but on our readiness, on our deservedness. He made a promise, and he released us based on his promise, not based on what we earned. So we need to know that there is an energy, Seder night, of I don't know how you say it, psicha, but lifsoach, there's an energy of skipping over, where we could daven for the spiritual heights that we want. And Hashem will grant it to us, because Hashem will skip over our preparations. And he's not going to say, well, you didn't actually learn that, work on that, take charge of that. No, it's a night of skipping over how ready you are for that level.
So honestly, have you ever felt a difference?
You have to ask for that difference. That's the trick.
Yeah, but you can ask, but you don't really get that.
I don't know.
I've never had that.
Try it. Try it this year. See what happens. Try it. Take a minute before you sit down at the table or in the middle or when you get up to go get something to serve. 1 minute to daven. Pick something beforehand that you want, right? And say, like Hashem, this is a night of passing over whether or not we're ready. And this is what I want to achieve. I want to, whatever you want, I want to understand this. I want to be there. I want to be holding here. I want to feel like this is mine and I chose it. Please help me get there. Right? And see what happens. Now, we have to know with Pesach, just like Hashem skipped us over all the levels, and then he gave us, Sfiras HaOmer, 49 days to not only repair the damage of the 49 levels of Tuma that we sunk to, but also to build the platform underneath 49 days up to the level he skipped us up to before he gives us the Torah. So we have a little chance to work on it during Sfiras HaOmer. But it is an energy, that Seder night is the energy of passing over prerequisites. And we have the opportunity to strive for a spiritual height that we didn't yet earn.
Mm-hmm.
So try it. Let's see it. We'll make an experiment. Think about
what
you
want.
And if not,
then...
Give it a try. And then we'll report in the summertime if we feel a difference or not. I don't think we'll feel it immediately. But see what happens.
Right.
It can't happen if you don't ask, that's for sure. But if you understand, there is an energy that you could hop, so try to hop it. Extra insight into something, or
right.
Extra connection to something. It's a night of hopping.
Right. I'm for sure going to try, but I don't think I've ever seen, like I've tried in the past. It's not like, unless I'm
You've
not being measurable.
Uh-huh. Well, let's see. I mean, I could definitely testify for myself that I can't believe I'm living the life that I'm living. You know, it's amazing to me when I think about the family that I was born into and what I'm doing now, how many levels must Hashem have skipped me to get me here today? I didn't earn all this. So for sure Hashem has helped out a lot along the way, and I'm going to ask for more. Why should I be satisfied? I want to achieve a lot. So that's my plan. So we'll end with that. You should be zeicha to think of something good to ask for. Ask for it, and Hashem should skip you right up to that spiritual level.
Amazing.
So.
Thank you so much.
Good. Let's be in touch. Are you getting any emails at all? Or should I call you next
here
time?
And there, I check it. I mean, you can send it, but I don't check it regularly.
Okay, well, we're going to take a break anyway till after Pesach. So,
yeah.
So Bezrat Hashem, we'll be in touch during or slightly after Pesach to start up again.
Brilliant. Thank you so much, and enjoy Pesach and the
Kliyot. Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye.